America's military policies in regard to service members can be described as an awkward attempt to balance the need to win wars with the desire to support a caste system that relegated Black Americans to second-class citizenship. President Harry Truman desegregated the military in 1948, making it an unlikely champion for inclusion and equity. In his book, The Armed Forces and American Social Change, An Unwritten Truce, author and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Troy Mosley details the military's progress and setbacks, while also honoring the pioneers that came before. Troy Mosley, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Angela.
Thank you. We're glad to have you here. So integration with the U.S. military, it helped lay the groundwork for the civil rights movement.
Yes. So, as you stated, Harry S. Truman desegregated the armed forces through an executive order. But what is less known is that the impetus for that executive action was violence being, you know, put upon Black American servicemen who were returning from the war. In their mind, they felt that they had paid their dues representing the United States in battle, fighting for the freedoms they themselves didn't enjoy at home. And they felt that their sacrifices had earned them the right to full citizenship, which they had been denied due to the Jim Crow laws that ensued at the end of Civil War Reconstruction. So this classic clash of cultures led Truman to integrate the armed services to kind of put an end to the violence that was occurring across the United States. And also, being a World War One Army veteran himself, this same phenomenon occurred after World War One. But the president at the time didn't have the political will to address the situation. So, you know, we are familiar with that expression that history doesn't repeat itself, but it kind of rhymes. So if we don't learn the lessons, then we're at risk of repeating the failures of past generations.
And I'm curious, because as you mentioned in the book, and, you know, there have been blacks have been in the military during, you know, most of the wars, and this was happening and it was ongoing. What made Truman, like, I know you said the violence, but as you also mentioned, people were treated violently, and you detail some of this. It's pretty horrific. You detail this in the book, but people have been treated terribly. What put Truman in that position to finally say, no, this has to stop?
You know, Harry Truman is an interesting figure. He was the last American president not to have a four-year college degree. But he was also a very well-read man. He was intellectually curious, and he read history. He understood the gravity of his position following the conclusion of World War II. The world was war-torn, and he understood America's challenge to be an influence in a larger world. We were competing against the Soviet Union to proliferate democracy as a system of governance for a war-torn world. And so understanding that the way we treated Black and brown Americans in this country was the Achilles heel of representative democracy. And Truman understood he had to do something about that to secure our moral footing to promulgate representative democracy as a system of governance that the world should emulate.
Oh, wow. And then that, when I'm always stunned when I was reading your book, just can you talk a little bit about the response? Because he did this, he did it with a stroke of a pen, and yet there was definitely pushback. Can you talk a little bit about that, just the response he got from other members of government, from the various branches of the military as well?
Oh, sure. There was a tremendous response, as social scientists and social engineers understand that change is difficult. People don't, you know, particularly like to undergo change. And part of the inertia that Truman had to overcome was just the reflexive experience we have as a function of resisting change, but also the deeply ingrained racism that had to be overcome. A lot of the violence that was being perpetrated was by actual law enforcement, because at that time, segregation was the law of the land, and so in many regards, they were doing their job, which led to these clashes. But specifically, the resistance to this executive order happened in many different ways, and I think it's interesting that each of our armed services kind of has their own culture that, you know, it's still very prominent to this day. The Air Force is probably our most technologically oriented force, them and the Navy, and they take pride in being progressives. And so for the Air Force, because they were also a new service, mm-hmm. during World War II, they were the Army Air Corps. And then following the war, one of the many changes that she went ushered in was reorganization of the armed forces, and the Air Force became its own service. They had no problem implementing the executive order. They did it without issue and very, you know, effectively. Similarly, the Navy, also being a highly technological service, didn't have as much resistance. The Navy had done some things during the war to kind of experiment with integration, and I think that put them on a better footing. The Army and the Marine Corps struggled the most. The very first Secretary of the Army was, in fact, relieved of duties because, in Truman's estimation, he was resisting the executive order. So, I don't think there's anything that you could take as a greater form of resistance. It would be like today if President Biden fired Lloyd Austin for not doing something that President Biden told him to do. You know, it is that type of bitter resistance to change that this executive order confronted in 1948 when Truman gave it. And in fact, it took the Army 6 years to fully implement the order. In 1954, under duress in Korea, General Matthew Ridgway requested relief from some of the segregationist practices that were being put in place at the theater and, you know, four-star and three-star general level. And that was the last units to be desegregated were in 54. The Marines kind of drug their feet, but because they are in many ways subordinate to the Department of the Navy, there's one secretary, cabinet-level position, that oversees both the Navy and the Marine Corps, so the Marines didn't have as much latitude to resist the order, and they were kind of drugged into it unwillingly, like the Army.
Oh,
but I think the thing that is very important to point out...
Oh, could you hold that? I want to continue this. We have to stop for break.
Sure.
We will be back in 1 minute. You're listening to the Keenest Observers on the Jefferson Exchange. And we're back. You're listening to the Keenest Observers on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation we're having with Troy Mosley. We're discussing the U.S. military and its history of integration and lack of previously. You can phone us at 800-838-3760 or shoot us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Troy, I didn't mean to cut you off there. We were talking about the Marines dragging their feet, and I wanted to pick that up.
sure. My point there simply was that the Marines have a culture of being a very elite fighting force, the few, the proud. And that is exactly what we need them to do. They do forced landing entries onto combatant shores by sea. So it takes a special skill set to do that. Very physically tough, mentally tough men and women who perform that. Everybody's not cut out to be a Marine. But when you put yourself back in time, that philosophy extended to those skill sets being unique to a certain race of people, white people. The Marines didn't really have any black service members until World War II, and the Marine Corps was established in the 1770s during the Revolutionary War. So they've got decades at that point of being an all-white elite fighting force. There were no Hispanics, no Asians, no blacks, certainly no women. And this executive order forced upon them a type of change that society writ large was not prepared for. And their reluctance was halted because they are, in many ways, subservient to the Department of the Navy. The Navy kind of couriers the Marines around to the places they need to be. And instead of having a secretary for the Air Force, you know, civilian leadership of our armed forces, Secretary of the Army, Navy, and Marines, Marines are lumped in with the Navy. And so the Navy kind of said, knock it off, and implemented, you know, the desegregation order as opposed to dragging it out like the Army did.
Now, does the
Marines... Go ahead.
Do the Marines still have that? Because I remember when I was younger, and my uncles, I've got Air Force and Army relatives, and there was this kind of don't join the Marines because they're not as friendly to people of color. Is that still a reputation it has, or has that changed?
You know, that is a very poignant question. And not having served in the Marines, I really don't want to speak specifically to that. I will tell you my personal opinion is that, truthful or otherwise, that notion does persist. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the Marines are not as open to the proliferation of ethnic diversity. I do know this. I know that during the summer reckoning of 2020, with the murder of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, mm-hmm. the Marine Commandant, General David Berger, banned the display of Confederate symbols on all Marine Corps bases mm-hmm. when he learned that the organizers of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville were Marine veterans. And I do know that the Marines are dedicated to equality of opportunity and are a stated non-discriminatory organization. And I really believe they believe that, and they work hard to ensure that is a part of their cultural ethos today.
Oh, wow. And you mentioned this in your book. You talk about kind of that ebb and flow of social change, where it feels, you know, it feels like one step forward, two steps back sometimes, but there is this kind of forward motion with the military overall.
Yes, well stated. So the name of my book, Unwritten Truths, comes from what I describe as the delicate balancing act that the military had to win our nation's wars. But at the same time, being a conservative institution, they don't want to be on the leading edge, if you will, of social change. But there are times in our nation's evolution where pragmatism forced them to be on the leading edge, as with the executive order in 48 to integrate. And if we go back to the end of the Civil War, what a lot of times we lose sight of is that Abraham Lincoln was assassinated 5 days after Lee surrendered because the Southerners were fearful of Lincoln's vision of the ensuing peace, that he would make the formerly enslaved people equal to the white Southerners. And that was an outcome that they simply could not have. And as a result of that, I believe Lincoln was assassinated. I believe that was the prevailing thought that pushed the conspirators, John Wilkes Booth and his co-conspirators, to make that assassination. The South was very clear about declaring why they seceded from the Union, and it's well documented in the cornerstone speech of white supremacy. The Southern states, although they accepted the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, they never rescinded that specified belief in white supremacy. And I think that's why we as a nation have kind of ebbed and flowed. There are people who are unrepentant segregationists that simply change their vision for governance into a kind of underground resistance to social change and inclusion. And I think that speaks to the ebb and flow.
Yeah, and there's something in your book throughout the stories you share, and I do want to say for the listeners, you've got these stories of heroism, and yes, there are some stories of some terrible things being done to men and women in the service, but also these stories of great heroism, and you point throughout about the importance of understanding this very history, those racist structures that were in place from a long time ago and continue to harm Black, Indigenous, people of color, women, LGBTQ+, that there's an importance in learning about this and in understanding that. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that, given the current resistance to history and the ideas of critical race theory?
Yeah, sure. What a fantastic question. I'll do my best to do justice for it. But kind of as I see it, the cultural clash that we are living through right now revolves around what it means to be American and who is entitled to be American. And we see that in everything from the struggles with police violence in the Black Lives Matter movement and equal justice, to the violence that's predicated upon people of Asian ancestry because of vitriolic hate speech that has been levied against our Asian brothers and sisters because of, you know, unfounded or ignorant beliefs about COVID-19. These are all classes of ideology. We see it with resistance to full inclusion of transgendered people. President Biden, one of his first actions was to reinstate or get rid of the ban for transgendered people to serve fully and openly in our armed services. And over time, I think we have narrowly defined what it means to be an American and who is entitled to be an American, such that when we see the changes in our society that are closing the gap between what we profess in our founding documents and our lived experiences, some people, some white Americans feel threatened by us coming closer to what we state. And there is a belief that America is their country and they're somehow losing it, when in fact, no one single community owns the American brand. It has been cultivated by the contributions of all Americans from all races and genders. And I think once we have a better understanding of those contributions, that we can fully get behind what is professed in the Constitution, which is a belief in equality. And that is the thing that makes America exceptional. For the first time in the history of the world, people have the audacity to put in writing that all men, and by extension, we include women, are created equal.
Thank you. Thank you. Very well said. You're listening to Jefferson Public Radio. This is the Keenest Observers on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our conversation via email at jx@jeffnet.org or give us a call at 800-838-3760. I'd love to hear from people who've had experiences in the military and who wish to speak with Troy Mosley. And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mosley, for all of this. I do want to talk a little bit also about women in the military. You devote a lot of time to just sort of that same movement of women in, you know, again, going back to the Revolutionary War all the way to now, and how doors were opened for them, particularly around World War II, but also throughout our history.
Yeah, sure. Women are a vital part of our nation's defense structure. Women comprise about 14% of our active forces. And I would submit that even going back to World War I, that women's suffrage was influenced by the service of women during World War I as switchboard operators and nurses. And their contributions weighed heavily on the legislatures that changed the Constitution to give women the right to vote. During World War II, we had women that served in the women's auxiliaries doing jobs that typically were performed by men in a peacetime world, but we needed, you know, all of the fighting strength on the front lines of two theaters of war in the Atlantic and the Pacific. So those peacetime jobs were handed over to women in communications. We had women who would fly aircraft from the factory to the port of deparkation so that they could be loaded and sent abroad for our service members to use. Oh. And in that tradition, we evolved to include the women not only as auxiliaries, but as a full part of the armed forces. And with that full inclusion in the 1950s and 60s, we did pay equity for the first time in large numbers, because the military is a rank-structured organization and pays based on your rank and your years of service. Shortly after that, we get women who are in charge of men in large numbers. You know, that was something that was somewhat unique in American society and culture. But I think the real breakthrough that the military had in influencing society more broadly with respect to gender equity was in 1976, when the service academies began accepting women into the Naval Academy, the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, the Air Force Academy. Because up until that time, the Purdue Universities, the Virginia Techs of the world, the Georgia Techs, you know, they were not accepting women in the medical fields and the hard sciences. And once the service academy started doing it, there was really no cogent argument they could formulate to continue to exclude women.
Oh.
So I say that was a seminal moment that our military should be proud of in influencing inclusion of women in STEM careers.
Yes, indeed. I want to go back to that. We've got a phone call. Mark in Merlin. Hi, Mark. You're on.
Oh, great. Thank you. I was in the U.S. Navy in the very early 70s when I first got in. There was a program that was still in place that had been put in place by MacArthur. MacArthur had a special relationship to the Filipinos, and he had decided that he wanted Filipino men to be able to be stewards in the U.S. Navy. The difficulty was the program that got established locked those folks into that rating. They couldn't go and apply for other jobs, only stewards or someone connected with the supply chain that did the cooking in the mess decks. And that didn't disappear until the mid to late 70s. I'm wondering if your guest knows anything about that program.
Troy?
Great question. You know, I don't know specifically about that program, but I would submit to you that was probably residual resistance to Truman's executive order, because he was very specific to state all MOSs, military occupational skills, should be open to all U.S. citizens, regardless of race. Now, up until World War II, the military's policy regarding the use of manpower restricted Filipinos, Black Americans in the Navy specifically, from serving in combatant roles in some of the more technologically oriented roles, such as sonar operators or radio telephone operators. They were stewards. And that was supposed to have changed with the executive order of 1948. Great question and good insight. I'll have to go look that up later.
Thank you, Mark. I'm wondering, just given Mark's question, did that happen a lot where people were relegated to one specific role and then not allowed to break out of it, so that they were sort of technically allowed less restrictions, but not really?
You know, that was a feature of our segregated armed forces. The Navy did not have any black officers until 1945, almost the end of World War II, because there was the prevailing thought that black Americans did not have the intellect or the wherewithal to perform highly stressful, highly technological skills under duress. The Navy did an experiment where they had 13 officers admitted into their officer training school. They were called the Golden 13. And they were given the aptitude test to become an officer. They did so well on the test, the Navy did not believe the results and had them tested again. And it was that type of mindset. You have to remember, in the 1940s, America was virulently racist compared to the way we are today. Separate but equal was the law of the land. And the prevailing notions that undergirded that separation were very much in play. And the individual actors, the people who held positions of responsibility, couldn't help but be influenced by the society in which they grew up in.
Wow. Wow. And that was, the Tuskegee Airmen were an experiment as well, right? Where they were given this assignment and then they just sort of busted out and broke all the, you know, just broke down all these barriers and surprised everybody.
Yes, the Tuskegee Airmen were an experiment. And you have to remember that during World War II, we had all of these beliefs about abilities that were directly tied to race. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we were trying to fund a war that cost billions of dollars. And so black Americans saw the war as an opportunity to prove their mettle, to prove their worth. And black Americans across the nation, in some of the black media outlets, the Pittsburgh Courier, would say, if black dollars are good enough to buy U.S. warplanes, then black men are good enough to fly them.
Oh, yes.
And there was a civic organizational pushback from within the black community to petition the government to expand the roles for black Americans and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans.
Oh, wow. But, I mean, we've got some music coming up behind you. I want to pick that up when you get back. Thank you. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Jefferson Public Radio, the Jefferson Exchange. Stay with us. And we're back. You're listening to the Keenest Observers on the Jefferson Exchange. Join our conversation at 800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.com. Org. Troy, I do want to pick up what we were talking about the push to get more blacks in the military, more black people flying planes. I do have a drop-off from Lonnie about women sailors. Lonnie and Ashlyn, women have been legally allowed to be submariners. Is it submariners? Since the 1980s.
That's good.
Thank you. But you still won't see a submarine with female sailors. Can you speak to that, if that's the case?
You know, that's something that I can't speak directly to firsthand as far as the assignment of women sailors on submarines.
Mm.
More broadly, I can tell you that over the last 15 years, the United States military has broken down numerous doors, including having women able to command submarines, to command war vessels. We now have women in our most elite, exclusive warrior schools, such as the SEALs, the Rangers, the PJs in the Air Force. They used to be men only. Women were not allowed to participate in those schools. And I think during the Obama administration in 2015 or 2016, that policy changed to allow women not only in the elite service schools, but to allow them to serve as combatants in infantry units and in Marine Corps units to fulfill, you know, their potential and their desire to serve their nation as combatants in their chosen field. I think it's important to remember, we have been an all-volunteer force for about the last 50 years, and excluding people based on superficial characteristics is a luxury we really can't afford.
Now, you mentioned that in your book also, that having diversity in the military is an advantage. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. Like, why is it a strategic advantage?
Yeah. Theoretically, we would be able to infiltrate any enemy because we have people who understand their culture, who can speak their language, who look like them. So if we are true to our stated values, that we don't discriminate based on race, religion, gender, creed, or color, those people who live within our republic will see the armed forces as an avenue to advance their own careers and fulfill their own patriotic aspirations. I mean, I say that human resources, our people, are one of our greatest attributes as a nation. Mm-hmm. That potential is only potential unless we accept it, harness it, and cultivate it.
No, and you mentioned this also, that the military, it's basically this great equalizer. And as I was growing up, that's how we discussed it as well, is if you go into the military, you can get job training, you can get an education, you can get respect that wouldn't be afforded elsewhere. And that's still the case?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I think the military has the bones to be one of America's greatest meritocracies.
Mm-hmm.
Because we accept service members from all over the country, from rural America, from the inner cities, from suburbia, and we put them in the same environment, we give them the same training, the same food. It's gotten better over time. And it is in that crucible that we learn that merit and willingness to serve are the most important characteristics. When we take our service members and soldiers to the shooting range, you know, bullseye is a bullseye. It doesn't matter who shot it, and it's easy to see you know, who your star performers are in certain aspects of military training, be it marksmanship or land navigation, or, you know, who can do the most push-ups. You know, you're right there, you count them out. And I think it is that meritocracy that allows people to come together from different walks of life to rally around their contemporaries that distribute excellence in one particular field or another. And it is through their collaboration that they're allowed to progress together to advance and graduate from these difficult courses. Their ability to unite and help each other out. And I think it's just a wonderful experience that I wish more people could have.
Wow. Well, thank you. We've got a call from Gary in Applegate. Gary, you're on.
Hi, this is Gary. Yeah, I was calling to ask whether your guest is aware of or has maybe more information about what happened at Port Chicago in the San Francisco Bay Area when black sailors were given the duty of loading munitions in World War II, and it was very dangerous, and some of them had a lot of doubts about wanting to do that, but they were given that assignment, and as it turned out, there were some munitions that apparently got jostled or dropped, and the whole place went up, and they were killed.
And Troy?
Was it Gary?
Did you know the Port Chicago attack?
Yes, Port Chicago was a very unfortunate incident in our nation's military history. Again, this kind of goes back to the types of jobs that were available to black servicemen when they were drafted into the Navy. There were only certain jobs they could do, be a mess attendant on ships or like small cities. So they have to have people to do the laundry, people to do the cooking, et cetera. On the shore duty, tasks such as loading ammunition, moving boxes, logistical tasks were tasks that were afforded to black sailors because they were prohibited from being in combat. And in this particular situation, the work conditions were not adequate. The demand for production were unreasonable. And you had a group of mostly all black sailors being led by white officers who may not have advocated for them as vociferously as they should have for better conditions, or didn't understand them or believe them, but there were certainly some trust issues at work there that were largely predicated upon the difference in race, and it led to tragic outcomes. I can't tell you how many hundreds of sailors were injured and killed in that explosion, but there was a tremendous explosion that could be felt and registered on Richter scales, in which hundreds and hundreds of Navy sailors were killed, and some who refused to perform the duty were charged with mutiny and actually court-martialed. I wish I could tell you the outcome, of the court-martial or the number that were injured. I think that'd make a great Hollywood movie if someone were to take that on. Thanks for the question.
Thanks, Gary. I'm assuming that was the case for a lot of missions, that the black people and other people of color were considered more expendable as well.
Well, the military's thought process was that white Southerners were better apt at leading black servicemen because they were accustomed to overseeing. My hands are in finger quotes right now. Black, service members. And there was also a prevailing notion that black service members were lazy. And, all of the stereotypes about being slow, unintelligent, and lazy. The military thought that the Southern officers were the best ones to lead them, when in fact they may have been the worst ones to lead them, because many, not all, but many of them brought their own prejudice, their own baggage to the assignment, and quite frankly resented being put in charge of black service members because they were then cordoned in their opportunities to serve in combat and write back home and say how many Germans they captured or how many Japanese that, they defeated. So it wasn't a good mix, but that was the official policy back in those days.
I'm always surprised. Of course, the military would mirror, would mirror our society. And so as I was reading your book, I was just constantly surprised at some of the progressive things that were done. And then at the same time, like we said, there was this ebb and flow. It was a few steps forward, a few steps back. And one thing we didn't talk about that is discussed in your book are some of the defining moments for LGBTQ plus soldiers. Can you talk about that and also the impact of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Sure. In the book, I have a chapter dedicated dedicated to LGBTQ equality. It goes back to before the Continental Army was founded. General von Steuben was a German or Prussian officer who came over to help organize the American military in a model after the Prussian Army, who at that time was considered to be the foremost army in the world. General Prussian was either gay or bisexual, and that's pretty well documented. George Washington sent him an aide who was also believed to be gay or bisexual to translate from German, Austrian, into English the marching and drill manuals that our nation used as a bedrock of developing the Continental Army. And, you know, gay men and lesbian women have always been about 11% of our population. And it was believed in early modern warfare, the 1940s, that gay men were vulnerable to blackmail or otherwise untrustworthy. And so that was the reason that was articulated for their exclusion. If it became known that you were a gay man or a lesbian woman, those were legal grounds for you to be separated from service. And what we found over time is that that's just simply hogwash. There's no truth or credibility to that. And President Clinton ran on allowing, you know, gay men and lesbians to serve openly in the military. He was unsuccessful. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the compromise that came out of that. And I say it was a necessary compromise because it brought us from full exclusion into allowing, you know, our gay community to serve. And 15 years henceforward, they found that that exclusion only served to prohibit the gay men and lesbian women from making deeper and meaningful connections with their coworkers, and in that regard, not being able to advance to the limits of their potential because they were still somewhat closeted. And so in 2014, I believe it was, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell doctrine was stricken down from military annals. Wow. I also don't think it's a coincidence that shortly thereafter, we began to see a proliferation of marriage equality that began in Massachusetts, and certain other states began to accept civil unions. And I think it was because of that service, the ripple effects, you know, just kind of made people open their eyes and see our gay citizens more broadly than just their sexuality.
And so once again, the military is sort of heralding these more doors opening. And it's so funny because when a military general, and I'm thinking of the Joint Chief of Staff's, I think his name is Mark Milley, when he said that he wanted to learn more about history. He wanted to learn about these racist structures that were in place, and that it was good to have an open mind. Just sort of the wellspring of support he got and the applause he got for that. What would you like to see the military do now? Like, what's the next step?
Yeah, sure. The military has got to figure out a way to protect our women service members. Right now, I would say that sexual violence is at a level that is, potentially pandemic or certainly endemic. And we lose thousands of, particularly women, every year because they're being preyed upon by people without scruples. And all too often, the perpetrators are not held to account. I think that the Uniform Code of Military Justice should carve out sexual assault as a case that needs to be adjudicated by a disinterested or a dispassionate legal party. The chain of command has proven time and time again that they're not up to the challenge.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much. We have to wrap it up, and that went by really fast. You're listening to the Keynes Observers on Jefferson Public Radio. We're at Jeff Exchange, and we'll re-air tonight at 8, from 8 to 10. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mosley.
Thank you so much. It was my distinct pleasure.